Hello and welcome to the CTO series, a collection of interviews with tech leaders from some of Australia's biggest and fastest growing businesses, hosted by Terem CEO Scott Middleton. Today's conversation is with Stephanie Sheriff, who is the VP of Engineering at Spaceship. In this conversation, Scott and Stephanie discuss how to bridge the gap between engineering and business requirements, as well as how her team adopts new technologies quickly. Here's Scott.
So let me just kind of start kicking us off. So I'm Scott. I'm from Terem. So we're a tech product development and strategy firm. We love building tech products, whether we're embedding engineering teams to help you kind of build out your roadmap, whether we're working on product strategy with you, we love it all. And you know, one of the things that I love about the webinar series that we do is also something really important to us is sharing all the great work that goes on in the Australia, New Zealand tech community. And this tech, the CTO series has been something we've been running for a couple of months now. And Steph is our next great guest that I'm really looking forward to chatting to. So I'm Scott. I've been involved in 61, like a lot of product launches. I built Terem to be one of the fastest growing companies on the AFR's Fast 100 list for 2 years in a row. And that's all through building good product for our clients, which are tech companies and enterprise and government. I, on a personal level, like I love sailing and I usually talk about sailing and other things, but at the moment I'm trying to perfect chainsawing, which I just remembered when I was chatting to Steph about Steph's new hobby, which is Steph is building a camper van. And like me, I had no experience doing chainsawing or any of the hands-on stuff. I've always been dealing with technology. Steph, you picked up part of the reason for getting into the camper van was so you could work out how to build a camper van. I'd love you to share a little bit about the camper van, and then I'll talk about your professional experience, which we're all interested in as well. But yeah, talk us through the camper van.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like totally opposite to anything I know. I have a little bit of experience like with my grandpa building some stuff, but I literally haven't done anything with my hands. So I thought it was a new skill to learn. I think it's a good, important one to have as well. So yeah, it seemed like a good idea at the time. We'll see how it goes.
My father-in-law, who was a mechanical engineer, used to say, he's like, Scott, you're not a real engineer. And I was like, no, I'm a software engineer. Like we do engineering, but I've now come to realize like it is very different stuff with like physical things versus digital things. So and a bit more for everyone around Steph's background. So Steph started at Spaceship, been there for, I think, about a year, just under a year and a half, year and a quarter or two. Been a software engineer for a bunch of years. Oh, sorry, you go. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I've been here for 4 years.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry. You've been running as the VP. That's where I've got the number from. VP of engineering for the last year and a bit, but been there for quite a while. A lot of experience in software engineering. And I guess like to really jump into it, Steph, would love to, just before we jump into why the topic, could you just give us like a really quick summary of how big's the engineering team at Spaceship? How many engineers are in it? What kind of structure you've got?
Yeah, for sure. So the engineering team at the moment is 11, 12 including myself. Yep. We've got DevOps front end and back end, and that's a little floating because we've got a bunch of people who can sort of float full stack a bit, and then a technical product manager who helps us a bit with our documentation and planning and delivery. But yeah, so we're heavier to the back end side of things, which is why it helps to have some people full stack. Because everything's a little bit under the iceberg.
And I think that leads us nicely into why you chose this topic of just to run back, which is balancing engineering and business challenges in a fintech startup. And I'd love you to share with everyone, why you chose this topic to talk about.
Yes. So, I mean, everybody in every business has to balance the business priorities and engineering. But it was something I actually learned when I came here that I didn't expect, is that trying to be a fintech startup in an environment where it's highly regulated, but you still have to sort of move fast and get stuff done, I think is all of that on steroids. Like, it's not that you stuff you want to do to make things better, it's stuff you have to do in order to keep moving forward. So I just think, yeah, it can help everybody, but it's just something like that we were required to do in order to be able to move fast and do interesting things.
Maybe talk us through a bit of like what is it, what's an example of that where you're trying to move fast but you've got to kind of slow down or address something because you are in a regulated environment, you're dealing with financial information. Maybe just for everyone to understand, like, what's an example of that in practice?
I can give some examples of sort of what we've put in place to enable some of this, which I think might help explain scenarios. So, I mean, everybody knows, you know, unit testing is really good to have. It helps it so you don't make mistakes. But if you think about it, like, in an overall sort of environment, it allows you to move fast because you can make changes and be more confident that what you're making isn't going to affect stuff that it is already there. So, I mean, it just becomes essential in order to move quickly. So if you have, you know, a statement, you know, that you send people and you want to make a change to that, if you want to not have to spend, you know, tons and tons and tons of time like going over every single element of it, if it's highly unit tested, you can be a lot more confident. Because like you mentioned, we're in a highly regulated situation. So, you know, a lot of startups, they can make a change and they can deploy it and they can move quickly. And if it's a bug, it's a bug, someone will report it to them and then they'll fix it and they'll move on. But we're dealing with people's money. It's regulated. You know, if we have a bug, it's not just about fixing it. You know, you have to report everything about it, even if it's not major. It's part of the process. It's part of the requirement of having, you know, a regulated fund. So it's just part of our lives.
And just to maybe just even clarify that even more, like, you're talking about a statement. So in your world, because your app is dealing with someone's super, it's a financial statement that, you know, at the end of the month, at the end of the quarter, the end of financial year, you might be sending them something saying, you know, this is your super balance. This is how much we made for you, or this is how much we lost for you in the current kind of market. Here's the fees that we charged. Here's the contributions you made. And this was the nature of the contributions because there's different kind of contributions you can make. That's kind of what you're talking about, having to present to someone and making sure that like all the elements of that are fully unit tested, right? The right harness is in place to make it easier for you to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Same for like, that's super. We also have a managed investment fund. So it's the same sort of things. That sort of info.
Do you, how often do you ship? Are you releasing every day, every week?
We sometimes release multiple times in a day. We pretty much just build in release. Like, it's a constant release pretty much, except a couple of situations, so everything goes straight out.
This is exciting to hear. Like, a lot of organizations in financial services, you know, the it's not possible, we can't do it because of the regulation, but the fact that you're able to do that is actually quite an exciting kind of situation. What so you mentioned like unit testing, what are the other elements that you've baked into your stack and your processes to enable you to do that?
Yeah, so I mean, unit testing is obviously a big one, but we consider code review like a first-class citizen. So, you know, engineers don't just, you know, write code and then go, oh yeah, and now I have to review code. Like, that's a first class citizen as far as what you do on a daily basis. So that is two things. Like, so we get a good code review. So two people have to review the code. And because it's a first class citizen, it's not just like, oh, I'll look over this and then I'm sure they've done the right thing. Like, we consider it extremely important that it's a shared risk that you're having people look at the code, review, and we're all taking on the fact that what's going out is correct. So that's a big part of our process. That also enables us to be fast because it is a first class citizen. You're not waiting a week for a review. I would say on average, I don't have this as a real stat, but it's more of a feel like on average, we definitely wouldn't go past 24 hours on a review, and it would be a lot quicker for most things. Only like really big things would maybe go longer than that. So we get things reviewed quickly and well. So that's a big part of it, unit testing and code review. We also have a lot of monitoring. So we've set up quite significant monitoring of the application so we know what's going on at all times. We also have, and it's sort of a dual purpose. We have like a feature flag sort of setup, dynamic configuration and experiment platform that can be used for experiments, but it can also be used to roll out stuff, and it can be used to sort of dog food to the team. So a lot of things like, yeah, we release consistently, but we don't necessarily show new features immediately. But what we can do is internal to the company, we can have that feature out for a while and have people testing it. And we really, you know, try to get everybody on board. This is their application, you know, this is their company, they need to be invested, and we get people, you know, looking at these things ahead of time. So that's a really big benefit as well. So I think those are the major things.
Yeah, interesting. And just on the code review one, that's quite a fascinating one. The turnaround time, do you have a set time in the day where everyone does code reviews, or is it just like everyone just gets to it in their own time? How do you work that into people's days and flow and their state of flow?
Yeah, everybody's a little bit different, which I think is okay. So some people will set, you know, a schedule at different times during the day where they're like, okay, I'm going to look at code review at, you know, 10 a.m. and 2 or 3 p.m. and they'll set that time in their day. And then some people do it continuously based on like if they're in the middle of a task or not. And it's really a personal choice. Yeah, and then if we have something particularly urgent, like maybe then we'll message, but we try, to just let that happen organically. Yeah. And because it's in the front of the mind, you know, people do it quite well.
And so it's become a bit of a team norm by the sounds of it, where everyone's kind of like looking out for each other a bit, I guess, and doing it for you. That's really interesting to hear. On unit testing, how do you think about code coverage? Like, you say you got quite a decent suite of tests, and how do you, and maybe kind of linked into that, how do you think about definition of done, or you know, like, is it, do you do the task then write the unit test, or like does the code review come back and say, well, coverage isn't good enough? Just really curious to hear more on that as well.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say we do like test driven development, which is obviously sort of write the tests ahead of time and then write the code, but we do consider the unit tests as part of the submission of your code review. So unless it's a very, very small chance, like an extreme situation or, you know, a copy change, if you've put up something for people to review, there must be unit tests. And yeah, for sure, we use those unit tests to help review code, at least from my point of view. That's a large part of what I help you use to review code. And there are many times where someone will say, you know, I don't think maybe this scenario isn't covered. Can you write another test to cover this? And so that is part of the code review. Do we have the tests that cover what we're trying to write? And you know, a while back we had, we just sort of all got together and thought about tests. And so we use our backend programming language is Go, Google's Go, Golang programming language. And it has, it's very well set up to write unit tests. Like it's inbuilt into the language, which is great. And the way it's sort of approached is that you test at a package level. That's sort of the input. So you were talking about code coverage before. We don't necessarily pay close attention to code coverage in the sense that, you know, making sure, you know, you pass through each section of code and you write a test that goes through the code. We consider it a bit more holistically, like making sure that each business case has a unit test. And we'd more look at code coverage in the sense that if code isn't being covered, does that mean either one, we don't have a business case that hits that and why is it there? Or two, yeah, are we missing a unit test that covers a certain business case? So trying to think of it from that level as opposed to, so using code coverage as a metric to sort of determine if we've sort of backwards that I think that maybe we were doing previously. And I think it was a real game changer in how we did unit tests and how we approached them. Yeah, so we don't necessarily concentrate solely on code coverage, but just use it as a metric to determine the quality of our tests.
Yeah, and when you say a business case, what does that mean in your context?
Yeah, so I mean, it's going to depend on, you know, what area you're testing. We have a microservice architecture, so. You know, let's say you're working, we'll go back to the case of statements. So if we talk about Voyager, our managed investment fund, if we talk about, let's say you're making a change to a statement, you know, you'd think about all the business cases that could happen in that statement. Like people have just bought, you know, they bought in, they haven't sold any units. So what's the expected view of their statement and is it all correct? Maybe they've bought and they sold in the same year. So how would that look? So you think about from not just like covering the bits of code, but the situations that would happen in the business that we have to cover for. Did they buy in a previous financial year and sell in this financial year? Like covering all those situations is where we're approaching when we think about unit tests.
And what about so we talked about unit, what about like end-to-end testing? Do you have tests that run across the whole, you know, imagine there might be multiple services involved in producing that, the that case you spoke about where someone withdraws some funds partway through a year or deposit, do you kind of like test that end-to-end or do you rely on the strength of the unit test to ultimately bring it together?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's something we don't do a lot of integration testing at the moment. We do rely very much on the strength of the unit testing and heavy just usage of our usage of the app and testing. That's probably okay for now in our sort of smaller team environment. I do think long-term, that's probably something more. We do have some end-to-end tests using some of the like monitoring tools and stuff that we have, but
yeah,
that's probably an area we can improve on, but we haven't run into too many situations where our heavily tested unit tests have hurt us. I think when we know there's a large integration, we tend to test that quite significantly from end to end.
That's super interesting to hear. Like it seems to be working for you. So it's really interesting to learn about. What about the monitoring side? You mentioned monitoring a few times. What's in your monitoring stack?
Yeah, so we use We use Datadog as our monitoring stack. So that does infrastructure and all of our services. We've built in some like custom stuff so that, you know, we have good alerts and we can see like the end-to-end requests. So we've built some custom stuff around it. And then we do have some front-end. Datadog also has some front-end capabilities. So we have stuff from our website and our app as well. So we get some alerts and errors around that. So we built pretty much everything on that. And yeah, it's a really great tool when you can really learn that in depth and use it. We have lots of dashboards. When we release a feature, you know, we build out a dashboard so we can really watch it and make sure that there's not a problem in a certain area. So we rely quite heavily on that tool.
Super interesting. And just you mentioned kind of changing tack a little. You mentioned the architecture that you've got, and we were chatting earlier about your situation of often a company's got a monolith. Is probably the default. And then you've got this challenge of like, all right, how do we start separating it out? You was mentioning that you had a bit of a different challenge in that you started with lots of microservices, and it sounds like maybe you've been consolidating a bit, or if not consolidating, wrangling the services. And I've definitely been in that situation as well, where you kind of all the tools and you go all in on microservices, and it's got its challenges as well, right? Like the monolith has its challenges, but equally microservices has its challenges. Love to hear your, like, first of all, could you give us a bit of context on the stack and the architecture, and then love to hear your thoughts on it.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm going to be honest. I don't know all the background of the why. I think that initially the company had hired contractors to come in to build out a lot of what was there when I first started. But I don't know the full context. But yeah, instead of going like starting small and starting with a monolith, it was sort of the exact opposite. Like it wasn't just microservices. Like we had like Kafka and, you know, event sourcing and like all this sort of, like there was so many services. Even everybody there like didn't even know most of them. Like being on support was, I mean, we were still small then, and being on support was just a nightmare, and nobody wanted to do it. And it was like two engineers full time on support, like trying to answer questions and dealing with everything. And so it was like, it wasn't just microservices. Like I said, it was Kafka and all these sort of surrounding tools. So, I mean, there was nothing wrong with it. Like it was well done. It was well architected. But for the size of company we were, it was just incredibly overwhelming to try to maintain. And I mean, I think we had multiple front ends. Like, so even those were microserviced out.
I can put my hand up and say, I am guilty of over-architecting. The engineer in me, just like there's one product in particular that, you know, I over-architected microservices everywhere. It was cool. Like it was very cool from an engineering standpoint. But yeah, from a like, especially when you've got a product that's evolving and changing, and you need people to support it. And as it evolves and team members change and all that, the architecture became challenging at times, for sure. I can totally relate to that. You looked like you're
So I was just gonna state, like, I mean, it's you know, sometimes in hindsight you look back and you like wish you had did something different. And like this is a case where I couldn't, like, probably the greatest that we ever made is a couple of the senior engineers. Then we just said, you know, this is too complex. We can't properly maintain and build on this. And we just, you know, went to the business who trusted us, luckily. And we just said, we need this period of time. I think it was 3 weeks, and we can't build anything new. We are just going to simplify to its ultimate basics, keeping microservices, but like pulling out every technology, everything that isn't necessary for us to run. And we're going to just simplify it to its basics. And we did it, and it was hard work, and it's the best thing we ever did. And since then, like, we put in place structures that basically, if you want to introduce something new, if you think something new needs to be introduced, like really heavy, honest debate has to be has to be a reason for it, and it has to give us something positive, and we have to be willing to test it in a small portion, and if it works for us, we roll it out. If it doesn't, you cut it and move on.
It's super interesting. In a fast growing startup, the cost of maintenance of features and functionality and infrastructure and services is often, and I say this because I've been guilty of it more often than I'd like, but like the cost of it, it's often easy to put in, but then every little, you know, like every line of code, every extra technology, every extra service just comes with an extra maintenance cost. Because if you go and even if you're not changing it specifically, you're changing something else, there's a good chance it's going to impact that thing that you, or the thing that you built originally is going to restrict the new thing you're building. And so you end up in this, it's a really kind of good lesson to share, because a lot of the let's call it the dogma is around decompose the monolith. Turn it into microservices, go market, you know, put in Kafka and like all the, put in event source, like the event sourcing, event streaming is like a huge theme that people are, and in another one, like we got to go micro front ends everywhere. And it's a really interesting thing that you're talking about, because you're not the only CTO we've had on the series that has said, one was like, we're keeping our monolith. We're not going to decompose it.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, like for a lot of people that might completely make sense for sure.
Yeah.
But just as a bit of a reference. So that was 3.5 years ago or so. And obviously since then, like we've expanded on our product offering and features that we have. And I mean, you know, our support is fairly low maintenance. It's not stressful. We normally have one engineer on, and they spend a portion of their time in the week doing it. So I mean, that's a massive improvement. And even now, years later, like it's still really at a relatively low level, which is great because it just frees up people to do
more
other work.
You can build features instead of maintenance. And yeah, interesting. And so what's your stack now, if you're okay to share? What are you running on, and what's in it?
Yeah, for sure. So it has, back then we pulled our stack back to the basics, and it was just Postgres database, Golang microservices. We use gRPC for communication between the microservices, and Protobuf as the interface, and then an API in front of all of that to our apps, which are React Native and React. So now we have expanded a little bit on what we have. So we did we pulled Kafka out. Then we used some PubSub capabilities, because we did have to move on from just using gRPC. So we do have some PubSub in our stack, and you know, we've fully embraced infrastructure as code. So we have Terraform that really builds out our whole stack. We can pretty much, I mean, there's still some small limitations, but like we could spin up the whole thing from code pretty quickly. So that's been another thing we've introduced. But other than that, and now we're using GraphQL for the API for the most part. So yeah, we're still trying to keep it relatively simple. But I think that's the important bits. Yeah.
And how do you organize the team around the stack?
So it's changed a little bit over time. depending on like what the business goals were. Right at the moment, we're sort of all in together as a team. So we're just sort of one engineering team working together on different business rules. At other times we had split depending on like what area of the business we're working on, or just like forming small teams to execute on a certain feature. But yeah, right now we've brought the team back together and we're just executing on business goals sort of together. Except DevOps, they sort of, you know, are on their own because they have to go ahead of us.
Yeah. But
for the most part, all back end and front end, yeah, we work together really.
Yeah. And do people own, first of all, it's really interesting that it's not a constant and that you're letting it evolve like as the needs of the business change is like a really interesting thing to hear. And I definitely see a lot of like, what's the one true model that we must apply to our organization design or our team design that's going to set us up for success? And I mean, just as you kind of share, like it changes and it's different and one might fit last month, but maybe it's not as relevant for what's coming up next, right? So that's a really interesting, how often do you change the structure, so to speak?
Try not to do it too much. It's really like we try something and if it's not working, we sort of retro and make small adjustments. I don't normally like to change like a massive amount all that often. It's more like small changes. I don't have the feel and. And yeah, when it just seems like it's not working, what can we try, to make things more efficient and better? I mean, I think as a small business, you know, it's easier for us to do. Obviously, someplace that's very large, that's a lot harder to do. But because we're small, it's easier, but also it's sort of required.
Yeah. And do people own like, is there someone who's like, oh, I own the statements service, or I own the such and such service, or does everyone, you know, if you're on the back end team, you're kind of across all the services? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a really good question. So, again, this is a case of like what works for small wouldn't work for large. So, for us, we almost have to make sure it's not siloed because we are small and someone might be working on something else and we need another person to jump on this. So it's actually pretty important to us that we do spread that knowledge so that we're not siloed. In saying that, obviously, like people have worked really heavily in certain areas, so they're sort of the go-to person. Yep. But make quite a conscious effort if like one person is like the main knowledge in that area. If we have another planning task or some new features in that area, that we get like someone else to actually work on it so we can spread that knowledge around so that it helps not only in support, but also, yeah, based on being small, if someone's sick or whatever, you can't like wait for them to come back to fix a bug. Yeah. So it's worked really well for us. Granted, that doesn't work long term. Like not everybody can know everything, but for us right now, it's really important.
Yeah. That's really interesting. And what about your practices that you run with? And I ask it with the thing that I want to add, you know, and when I say practice, like you're running Scrum or like, do you have a big back like that kind of, or Kanban or something? But and the kind of ceremonies you're using. But the specific thing is you're kind of answering, I'd love to hear going back to the original kind of key point for you, which is how do you do that and factor in the kind of regulation or you know, the kind of strict environment that you're operating in? How do you think about that with your practices?
Yeah, so like obviously we're small and we want to move quite quickly, but because of those things, I wouldn't say like we're waterfall, because we definitely aren't waterfall. Like, we try to work on things in smaller chunks and get stuff out and expand on it. But what we do have to do as a business, not just as engineering, is we do have to have more structure around our initial discovery work, our initial documentation and requirements and approvals. So, you know, in order that when something like engineering, you know, that we can work on it and get it done and not have to do a lot of rework, we do need quite a lot of upfront work on anything being done, so that risk and compliance can look at it, so that the content, you know, it's a lot harder for us to go, oh, we'll do this and wait for the content later. Like, sometimes you can, and sometimes the content is so heavily important to that page or whatever you're building or how you build it, that because it has to go through risk and compliance and be reviewed, and does it have to go to the lawyers, you know, like all that sort of stuff, it's better if we front load that and do actually quite a lot of documentation ahead of time. But small amount, like, we try to limit that and be really smart about it, but we do have to have quite a lot of pre-work done before we get into the actual work. And we do that in engineering as well, yeah, where we then plan out the feature ahead of time.
How who's responsible for that end-to-end, and how does that work with the, how do you and the rest of the business all kind of fit together? Because it sounds like, you know, you are quite an agile, and this word is so loaded, but like, when I listen to how you're running and you're shipping multiple times a day and you're working through the way you're describing how you're building, the fact that you're shipping multiple times a day, I'm like, oh, okay, there's continuous delivery going on, continuous integration, continuous release, which means like you're going in some good cadences and some good cycles, and there's agility there. But then it's interesting to me, often it's then the rest of the business in let's say more traditional or older organizations that don't want to work that way or not. But it's interesting to me that you seem to be able to maintain that even with lawyers involved and risk and compliance, who are maybe not as on board the agile bandwagon as everyone in tech is. How do you run that end to end in Spaceship?
Yeah, I mean, we're not, you know, everybody has their challenges. There's times, you know, where maybe, you know, we wish everything moved a bit faster, but given the environment, like it's so difficult. How we've tried to work and what we're keeping working on is, you know, we have sort of two streams of work come from different directions. We've got like a product who they luckily take a lot of the load in, you know, dealing with content and risk and compliance and all that, and they facilitate sort of discovery with us and with the rest of the business, and then sometimes we'll have work through like our operations side of things where it's like a more internal sort of experience, and they'll deal with that from their side. So I'm small, so luckily like we can just go and tap someone on the shoulder, which makes it really nice. But yeah, a lot of people above engineering really are work on facilitating that, which is really nice. And at times that can be tough, but you know, we're learning as a small organization and working together and getting better at moving quickly. Yeah, we have the ability, so which is nice, because like if it's like, okay, there's this opportunity, or we've learned this from data or whatever, we can really help the business in going, well, we can jump on that.
And we is can that because you can kind of easily tap the person responsible and go like, hey, we learned this from data, or we learned this. Is that kind of what you mean there? Because there's that easy path of conversation, communication.
Yeah. So if we are, you know, we sort of have a prioritization with a bunch of different areas of the business, and they sort of go, you know, we've noticed this could be, you know, really good to improve our onboarding here. Let's talk about this. Do we want to move this to the top? And, you know, we can just do that and then, you know, shift and jump on that. So, which is really, I mean, that's the benefit of a small organization. You can do that a lot easier when you're this size, and I think you have to take advantage of that.
Yeah, no, that definitely helps. And I'm just going to open up for like anyone we've got with us on in the audience, if you want to ask some questions of Steph or myself. I've got just to come back to this thing of I think you used the word when we were chatting earlier around safety with engineering. Like, have there been any mindset shifts that you've had to make within yourself or the team around, hey, we do have to have a high degree of certainty, or on the flip side, like maybe people have come from working in regulated environments and you're like, hey, it's actually okay to deploy a couple of times a day, or hey, I need you to move fast. Because it's interesting, right? Like, do you go and hire from the regulated kind of environment where people are used to that? Or if you hire from, you know, your consumer startup without regulation, then they're going to come in and be like, oh, why all the extra? I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Mindset. I think with engineering, like it's something like we've hired from sort of all over. So I don't think we necessarily think, I mean, it helps if people have worked in finance before, but we really just want to look for like good engineers that can learn and you know, really play a part in adding to the conversation, because you know we like to have healthy debates, so we're sure we, you know, pick the right direction. So in engineering, we haven't really concentrated on having people, but you do quickly learn, I think, as soon as you get into the team and experience the environment, how important we think that it is to consider these things. Like, we have to consider it, you know, when we're doing support requests, like, oh, is this bug need to be, you know, just brought up to be investigated? You have to think about the risk different things take. It's part of your job because it is small and everybody has to play a part in that, so that, you know, we can keep building features and don't have to spend time, you know, reporting things, which is really boring and horrible. So it's definitely a mindset people have to take, you know, that they have to, and they learn very quickly, like code review is important. Like, this is a mentality you have to take. Within the rest of the business, I think we've gotten a bunch of people who are like, I really like finance, but I hate, you know, that there's so much red tape. And so people who understand the environment, but also want to improve it. I think we've got a lot of people, we've got people from different places, but I'd say we do have people who have come from finance, you know, backgrounds that are sort of like, oh, but I want to like get some stuff done too. Like, I understand the regulatory environment, but I also want to get things done. So.
Yeah. No, that's a good, getting stuff done is a good thing to do, right? Just saying no for reasons. Yeah. And just with the, do you put anything together? Like, when someone on boards, you like, do you have posters, or, I mean, it's all virtual now, but that it kind of like, hey, you know, remember, like, posters are probably wrong thing now, but, you know, how do you embed that with people? Is it just getting them on board? How do you embed this thing of like, we're releasing regularly and often, but also we also pay attention to risk and compliance, and it's important. Yeah, what are the, when someone starts, like, what are some of the things you do with them to get them going on this line?
Yeah, the truth is we make it obvious in our interview process what the environment that we is. Yeah. And we found, you know, that the people who want to work here, they love what we talk about, how we do. They love that, you know, we have unit tests and we release often. And like, that's something that really they want to be a part of. So like, we make it really clear in the interview process that this is the environment we're working in. This is how we work. This is, you know, the things that we place importance on. And so it's quite clear up front that there's not a lot of surprises. And then once people are in, obviously, like there is this initial period where they get used to, they put up code and like, you know, they get 100 comments the first time because we have little stupid nits, because I also have another theory that like you shouldn't be able to look at code and tell who wrote it. Like, I don't want to be able to read some code and go, oh, I know Aaron wrote that. Like,
I feel like Aaron's in trouble. he's got the distinguishable code style.
Like, that's really important. So like someone will come in and, you know, there'll be a whole lot of what's seemingly minor comments. And I think it's like, they're warned. So it's like not a complete culture shock, but like, it's like, no, this is important because we want everything to look the same. We want it to be easy to review because we do things in the same way. And yeah, so I think it's known when they come in, and then it's quite obvious when they go through onboarding. We do have a lot of documentation, like especially like back end relating to like how we write certain things, how unit tests are done and all that. That's part of onboarding. But yeah, it's more upfront interview process, so everybody knows what they're coming into, and then yeah, the onboarding process and experiencing it.
Yeah. And changing kind of tack completely, because we've got about 5-10 minutes left. Just to change tack completely, what was the first language you coded in?
Oh wait,
I'd love to ask everyone this question.
like for real. Oh, Pascal, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, like elementary almost school.
Yeah. Okay. What did you write?
I don't remember. I did my elementary school or middle school. I don't know. They had like a computer class where you had like 6-week things where you tried different things, and one of them was programming, and it was in Pascal. I think, yeah. I did some Windows something. It was DOS, and I built a little menu to play my games, and like maybe some HTML when there was like GeoCities.
So yeah, cool.
That's all,
I remember GeoCities. That was a good and all the flashing yeah. Like straight,
yeah,
and the text that didn't quite work on the backgrounds and everything.
Yeah, but major one, C++ in university.
Yeah, okay, all right. So as a C++ was my first strong language. As someone from C++, what do you make of JavaScript?
I mentioned the other day to a team member who was going to give a talk, and I said, oh, his talk on JavaScript. And he said, he corrected me and said TypeScript. And he said, like, made a joke about JavaScript being dead. And I'm like, I'm perfectly happy for that to happen. I mean, being, like I said in my bio, a geriatric millennial, like I've gone through the scope of, you know, technologies. I mean, I'm very happy that Internet Explorer is dead. Like today, like it's like the best thing ever because of going through that time period of where development like in the browser was just horrible.
Yeah,
so
all the
backend.
I'm
happy with the backend is what I'm trying to say.
It's a very diplomatic way of avoiding the question of what do you think of JavaScript entirely. I'll accept it though.
I've looked at like what TypeScript has done and like what it's like today, and I mean, yep, it's quite an interesting, like much better language today. I can see why people like really enjoy it. It's much more exciting. Go is actually quite boring, but that's good when you're trying to build things like we build. Like boring is good, whereas like TypeScript and JavaScript and that whole world is quite interesting, I think. Quite compelling to a lot of people. I can understand that.
And last question is, what are your kind of tips on transitioning from engineering into leadership?
That's a hard one because I'm still learning myself. I think I think giving up that control is hard when you're so used to like having control, writing your stuff, you know, writing your code and being part of building the things and, you know, really instilling in your confidence in your team members and that you are confident they know what they're doing and allowing them to really take a hold and giving up some of that control, I think is really hard, but it's really important because you have to build a team around you can trust and everybody works together and you can have those strong conversations. And I think that's the most important thing you can do in that transition, moving into that leadership. You really have to let go, I guess, is the hard bit, and let other people, you know, take control.
Thank you for sharing that. There's just a question here from Tim. And Tim asks, do you meet any challenges after your customer base has grown up?
I'm not quite sure the direction that you mean. As the customer base grows, are there more challenges? Is that?
Yeah, I think. I'm trying to interpret it myself, Tim. Maybe you could clarify a little bit. But is it as the customer base grows, have you had challenges? So maybe you could speak to that one. I guess and then if that's not the question, Tim could post something different. But yeah, maybe you could speak to that one. Your challenges scaling your customer base.
Yeah, we've actually been kind of lucky in the sense that, like I spoke before about how we almost had to like pull back our architecture into something more simple. So we actually have a really strong base because of that. So by sticking with the microservice architecture, but just pulling it back, we were able to sort of build out an infrastructure that is going to grow with us for quite a long time. But in saying that, there's definitely things like as you grow and you get more people come in and there's a lot more throughput in the app, like there's definitely different challenges you have to face, which is like, for example, when we reintroduced, PubSub back into our architecture, it was solving, you know, a problem that just came from having more customers and more money coming through and more people and all of that. We just needed a way to handle it. So it's really solving problems as you grow.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That was the it. Well, we've got a little bit more time, so I'm going to just pop one more question in case anyone's got others. Like you mentioned, so you've been VP of engineering at Spatial now for over a year. What are your kind of big lessons to other leaders leading an engineering team, building a product out and going through the scaling that like you guys have been through some decent growth and awareness in the market? What are some of the challenges that could you share some of your lessons learned about leading engineering teams?
It's only been a year. How many challenges did you want to go through? Well, for me, because we're a small company, I think there was a real jump. Like I was leading our back-end team before moving into this role. And I think there was a real change and a lot of learning I had to do once I moved into this role, because now it's not just leading the engineers, but it's also communicating to the rest of the business and dealing with talking to the board and long-term planning and budget and all this sort of stuff that I was leading the back-end engineering before, but I didn't really have to deal with those sorts of things. So I had sort of learned to deal with people and how to talk with them and help them with their career and build that. But then moving where now you have to deal with the rest of the business along with that, I think that's the tough bit. And I think you just have to be open to learning from the people around you. You have to be okay to say to people, listen, tell me if you think things are good, tell me if you think things need to change, and learn from the people around you, like not just in engineering and the people you're leading, but also, yeah, like you have to be humble and be willing to take advice for sure. I think always learn.
We'll just go. There's one last question from Adi Bambo. Hopefully I got that right, which is, how do you gain the trust of management to allow time for refactoring in a fast-paced scale up?
Oh yeah, that's a really good one. So that's built over time, I think. I don't think you can immediately have that. And luckily at Spaceship, we did build that trust. So you really have to start building the trust with the organization that you have balance. So you have to be honest with them and not try to like fit in things that are unnecessary. So you have to build that by doing the right thing for a while in the beginning and you know, choose making decisions in the things you need to do. Like I talked about early on, how we asked the business, like, we need this time, we need to simplify this. And like that proved dividends. Like it made the business much more efficient. And I think when you can then show, listen, we asked to make this change and we showed that it was worthwhile. It wasn't just a vanity project. It was important to the business. So you do those things over time and you make sure that you work with the business. You have them understand. You just don't go, oh, well, they're not technical, they don't understand. You take the time, you get them to understand. And you only request what's needed and you don't try to do vanity projects. And then over time they realize, well, when engineering says this is really important, it's really important. And you do the same to the business. If you have to cut some time or do something maybe in a way you wouldn't exactly want to do, but you know, the business needs it right then. You know, you do it. You both take give and take and create, you know, this environment of trust that, okay, they're going to have that. We have to do this a little bit quicker and not in the way we wanted to, but we're going to get to fix that. And so there's this give and take relationship and you have to build it. And luckily in engineering, we built that quite early on, which has really made it great. I mean, our tech debt backlog is surprisingly short. So I think that goes to show that the business has really trusted us and it's worth building that trust with the business because it helps long term for sure.
Awesome, thank you. We've run out of time, Steph. Thank you so much for coming and sharing your insights around leading engineering teams with us, especially in fintech scale up. Really appreciate spending the time with us. If you're watching this on YouTube, you can hit subscribe and you can see the rest of the CTO series as well.
You've been listening to Terram CEO Scott Middleton talking with Stephanie Sheriff, the VP of Engineering at Spaceship, about balancing the needs of engineering and the business. We hope that you've enjoyed these conversations about tech leadership, and if you'd like to learn more about the work that we do, visit terram.tech or connect with us on LinkedIn from the links in the episode description. At our website, you'll find client stories, a list of our services, and plenty of blog content on topics such as agile delivery, creating high-performing teams, and building excellent products. Thank you for listening.